I guess those are my two visions. Like, one is to have a conversation with people in the firm. The other is to suggest what we can do as citizens right now through legislation and through other means to make corporations change the business landscape so that businesses have to adapt.
Today, Bart Elmore, professor of environmental history at the University of Alabama, on his new book, Citizen Coke, The Making of Coca-Cola Capitalism. In his book, Professor Elmore opens a window on the story of the role of major corporations in the modern world. It's a longer view of history and humanity that news cycles and market cycles rarely invite, particularly when it comes to questions of sustainability and public health. Professor Elmore himself is a kind of prism on the story of Coca-Cola in this century. Growing up in Atlanta, the heartland of Coke, and attending a school that was supported by the company, he continues to have a great affection for the soft drink. But in his book, he asks challenging questions about the sustainability and responsibility of the corporation. He argues that in a globalized world, we all have a personal stake in how this story unfolds. I'm Alex Rednick with EdgeFX.
I looked at some of your other interviews that you've done, and you talked about sort of the ubiquity of Coke, and you just mentioned it, and also that, like, some of the money had gone to fund Emory, right, and had funded your high school. So I was just kind of curious, like, I mean, it's definitely a Southern story, but it's not one that gets talked about very much.
Yeah, and why, right? I think that was one of the questions that was really interesting to me. What is it about the South that makes us kind of drawn to the agricultural products or the extractive industries of timber and cotton, tobacco? But I ultimately was like, no, it's Coke. Look at that thing. That thing is everywhere. Let's tackle that story. Over time, I realized, gosh, you know, trying to say this is a Southern story uniquely became pretty challenging because it really just quickly became a global story. Almost nothing in the drink is American or Southern. You know, it's like West African cola nut, coca leaf from Peru, cassia oil from China, sugar from the Caribbean, right? I mean, this thing, in many ways, was just an international product. For me, I said, well, Coke just kind of bucks all these trends. It's not it's not the typical extractive Southern industry. It's kind of an assembler of sorts. It's like you look at the winners of the 21st century, and they're not Alfred Chandler's U.S. Steel. They're not those. In many ways, there are these businesses that found ways to remain these kind of middlemen, these commodity brokers, really, make money off the transaction, not the producing of the stuff or the distributing of the stuff. You know, really just kind of being the connector between these producers and distributors. This was a book that was never meant to be just about Coke either. Coke shows us these patterns, but it also shows us its connections to, like, Monsanto and Hershey and General Foods. Like, it quickly became a story of all these different partners. It's finding out those other networks that make these businesses possible that I think is really fun.
Maybe take me through that story and how that sort of speaks to this larger point you're making.
Exactly. So, you know, I think this is a story that in which contingency is a key component of the narrative. Asa Candler is the president of the Coca-Cola Company in 1891. He's really the first president of the company, inheriting this brand from John Pemberton, who created Coca-Cola. And, you know, he decides in 1899 that he's going to allow people to bottle Coca-Cola, which he didn't really want to do. He thought that bottling Coca-Cola would be a stupid decision because bottling at that time was very rudimentary. He thought that bottlers around the country would ruin Coke's good name by messing with the quality of the drink and these kind of things. You know, spiders and mice and various things were getting into bottles at that time. He didn't want any of that. But he agrees to do it because these two lawyers from Chattanooga basically say, hey, you know, we really think we can make some money off this. Give us a chance. And legend has it, you know, that he signs away the rights to bottle Coca-Cola for basically $1. And there's just a great moment of contingency where it could have gone another way. And the question is, like, would Coke be a national brand in the way that it is today? Had he said, no, we don't want to do that. We're a soda fountain company. But in the end, he does. And that leads to the chapters that I write about recycling and all this packaging waste, you know, which really builds up in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, which, again, Candler could have never envisioned. He actually doesn't have any idea of how big this bottling business is going to be, but it takes off. So I think that story is really indicative of a lot of stories in the book where people make decisions within the firm that seemingly, you know, are kind of small decisions or maybe inconsequential to some degree at the time, but then they have these huge repercussions that I think play out in the book.
It seemed to me that, like, that was, you know, definitely a major takeaway of the book, right? And I maybe not one you started with, but this sort of notion of sustainability and also sort of government subsidizing of, like, different elements of the corporate structure, right?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, when I first started writing, I mean, just to kind of peel back the veil and just tell you how it played out, I actually, sustainability, which first of all I think is a kind of tricky term, you know, what does it mean to be sustainable? Is that really a good word to be using anyways? Well, that's another conversation. You know, those things weren't really at the forefront. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've read Alfred Crosby's Ecological Imperialism, but, you know, in the beginning of that book, he has this footnote where he basically says, or maybe it's even in the book itself, where he says, you know, basically ask simple questions, because complicated questions are, you know, have something about how complicated questions are too hard to give up. And he says, simple questions, you know, those will really lead you to paths that will be really interesting and intriguing. And that was simply the case. Basically, the way I did it as a graduate student, say, look, I just want to answer where the ingredients came from. Mm-hmm. You know, do that chapter by chapter without really knowing what the overall thesis is going to be, and just kind of see if I can answer this story chapter by chapter. And at first what I noticed was like this government relationship, but it struck me that, like, you know, water, the public water supply story was really intriguing, you know, how this progressive era expansion of public pipes made the bottling enterprises possible. Even with the sugar story, I think the story of kind of tariffs and the ways in which refineries were supported and these kind of things, there's a sort of government there. Or the coca leaf, you know, I think there's this clear government story. But when I got to the caffeine chapter, I realized that kind of this thing that even this thesis I thought I was developing really didn't fit so well for the caffeine chapter, because there wasn't as strong a government presence in that story as there was in the other one. And it was actually, so it was like in the fourth chapter where I was like, whoa. I'm not just talking about how Coca-Cola uses government to get these things. It's really using pretty much anybody, you know, whether they're private businesses, their franchise system, you know, in other words, wow, they don't own things. And it kind of, I never wanted to write really a business history that talks about the structure of the firm in relation to its environmental impact, but it came that late, you know, with the caffeine and being like, wow, Monsanto is doing all this for them, you know? And then seeing, going back and saying, wow, that's a pattern that I didn't really intend to find, but that's kind of at the forefront.
Well, it seems like the fact that it's not just a business history, that it's an environmental history too, really like brought that to the forefront, right?
What I love about environmental history is exactly that. It just allows you to go wherever you need to go. Mm-hmm. Indiana Jones was my, you know, inspiration as a young boy. I was always Indiana Jones, or a lot of Halloweens I wore Indiana Jones hats. And I'm a real outdoorsman. I like the adventure, you know. I like that. So I think I was kind of well-suited for this project because it did require me to get on the ground. You know, I did go to India and try to see for myself what the impact of some of these bottling plants were in certain parts of India, just to confirm things, you know, because there's so much misinformation out there. And then I went to Peru with my dad and, you know, went around Lima and Cusco and talked to people about the coca trade and the relationship between Coca-Cola and Peru, the Peruvian government and state. And, yeah, you know, got into the basement of the American Beverage Association and talked to a lot, you know, talked to other people that maybe weren't associated with Coca-Cola, but calling up all sorts of people that I could, and doing really investigative journalism, and just not being satisfied with the fact that, okay, there's no archive that's funding me to come here to do this. The information's out there. Let me see if I can go do it. So, again, I think it was, you know, stepping outside of just the regular archival research and getting your hands dirty a little bit. You know, one of the things I did, well, first of all, I followed them on Twitter for sure. That was actually really cool, too, because I got, they're basically feeding me primary sources, you know, through Twitter. Like, this is happening. Oh, look, in 1972, we posted this, you know, recycling poster. And it was just a, you know, to them, it's promoting their cause. To me, it's a primary source that I can analyze and think about what they're doing, you know. And then, let's see, I joined that. Then I joined their Civic Action Network, okay? This is a hidden kind of political action network that they created that you can sign up for, and they send you emails basically about political actions that they want you as a citizen to take part in to contribute to causes that ultimately benefit Coke. So, like, there would be, like, for example, when Mayor Bloomberg's ban on 16-ounce soft drinks came out, I got an email immediately that day from Coca-Cola saying, here's his Twitter account, here's his email address, here's his phone number, here's the other people in the city government that you want to contact. Call them today, write them today, tell them you want this ban gone, you know. And it was great. I was like, okay, I don't even need to go to the lobbying thing. They're showing me what their lobbying tactic is, you know, and activating me, you know, which I think is really funny.
The soft drink and obesity question is an interesting one, right? That you pointed out that you kind of have this local component to Coca-Cola that seems to go all the way through the story, right? From the very beginning, sort of how local vendors become very dependent on soft drink sales in different ways.
So with obesity, by the way, I was lucky enough to have access to documents in the basement of the American Beverage Association, which was the lobbying group for the soft drink industry. And I don't know why. I have no idea why they let me in there. But they did. And they did for a couple of months, and then ultimately my access was cut off. And that's in part because the person that let me in left the company, and then somebody else said, wait a minute, who's down there doing research in our lobbying, basically in the lobbying firm basement? And anyway, the point is, I saw then in 2000, probably 2007 and 2008, I mean, the issue that was the biggest thing for them was obesity. Mm-hmm. You know, they knew it. I mean, this is the writing on the wall. After, as I say at the beginning of that chapter, you know, it's one thing to say you're producing junk, you know, in terms of packaging waste. It's another thing to say that your product itself is junk. You know, that's a hard one. You know, you can change the packaging. You can do those things for the environmentalists. But when it becomes that the product itself is problematic, that's when it gets really, really troublesome. So they've known for a while that this is the big issue, and they've been fighting really hard. You know, since 2004 in the United States, soft drink consumption in the United States has fallen by 20% between basically 2004 and 2014. So, and it's largely because of this. You know, a lot of people are kind of wising up to the fact that soft drinks, you know, especially sugary soft drink, cooler soft drinks are, you know, filled with sugar that have these adverse effects, contribute to. They're not the sole cause. They're not the only reason that people are obese. But they're a major contributing factor, and so we're seeing that happening. And, yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about how do we send a message to businesses that we think this is something that should change. And I think we've seen in Berkeley, for example, the passage of soda taxes, sugar taxes, to try and, you know, put a price on the medical costs associated with not just obesity, but diabetes and other associated costs. I think those are good, but they have to recognize, as you said, the fact that small vendors do actually benefit from selling sugary products. And one of the things we've got to figure out is how to support vendors as they make the transition to a more healthy economy, you know. How do we support people that previously did make profits, small businesses that made profits off selling sugary things? How do we factor in their economic needs when designing a solution to the problem? Oof, right? Big questions with not a lot of answers, but I think the history suggest that we can't just think of obesity as solely a medical issue that doesn't affect the pocketbooks of businessmen.
I am kind of curious about this sustainability kind of question. Are people asking you about, you know, what does this tell us? What does this mean? How does this help us inform policy decisions? Those kinds of questions.
Yeah, so I'll give you a really interesting story. I'll try and keep it somewhat nebulous in terms of names because I think they're kind of in deals and negotiations right now. But a family friend of mine in India had Coca-Cola reach out to them. And my friend ultimately runs a company that creates health products. I don't want to identify too much about these folks, but basically the whole point is this family friend was working with Coca-Cola, and he read the book and actually told Coca-Cola this was one of the executives for the division of Coca-Cola for Southeast Asia, that if they wanted to sit down and broker a deal about the product that they were going to build together, they're going to have to read this book and have a conversation about it. And he welcomed the CEO to sit down with me, and I actually flew out to see my friend, and we were talking about, you know, maybe sitting down together, maybe going on CNN and having a conversation, a candid conversation, not about saying, look, this book is trying to destroy the Coke brand, but to sit down and say, okay, here are the things that we think are wrong, and how can we maybe address them, like have a real open, candid conversation about it. That was a really great vision, but the actual meeting between me and Coca-Cola's executives has not happened, though it's been an open invitation. And I think the book was actually handed off to them to say, look, I really agree with what's in this book. I want to do this business deal with you, but I want you to be able to follow some of the principles that, you know, the book's outlining, like pay your farmers a decent wage. Be responsible about the types of products you're producing instead of, you know, sugary beverages that are contributing to serious health problems. So within corporations, I think there's at least people that I know that are having conversations with Coke about it, which I think is kind of an intriguing thing, but I think we rarely see historians or anyone that does history in sustainability departments within firms, right? And that to me is just like, how can you possibly try out a sustainability path when you have very little real rigorous sense of the history of your firm, you know, and what it's done and how that's changed over time. So that's within the firm. Then I'll just say one other thing. I think for me, the book was always about the citizen and Citizen Coke, not necessarily Coke itself or working within the corporation, but about talking about what citizens, what we can do as people outside the firms to put pressure on businesses to do the things that we want them to do. And that's how I'd really like the book to be read, not necessarily about what Coke could do, but what we as citizens can do to reclaim our control over natural resources that we think are really important and valuable. And, like, one of the easy things that I always point to is, like, one of the big lessons, I think, of the book is if you don't make corporations pay for the pollution they generate, then they'll keep doing that, you know? They may become more efficient, they may reduce some of their footprint, but in the case of recycling in the United States, one of the things we've seen is we've kind of subsidized a lot of these throwaway container technology, allowing businesses to continue to produce plastic bottles and these kind of things, instead of putting a real price tag on those things that we don't think are good and seeing if business would adapt, maybe to go back to returnable systems or other systems that might be more ecologically friendly in the end.
It's kind of too bad they won't talk to you. In some ways, it feels like they become more sort of shadowy and like this monolith when you don't have actual contact with people in the organization.
Yeah, you know, like, to me, it's so crazy. I mean, I did all the things that are in the beginning of that book is true. I drank Coke, like, every day. I loved Coke. I thought Coke was awesome. When I started the project, I was totally willing to be like, wow, this could be a feel-good story of, like, positive and negative, you know? And there are some really good things they do, and I do try and include those things. But I think at the end of the day, you know, their voice is a bit muted because they chose that route. instead of actually contributing to the conversation. I'm not necessarily surprised by that. I mean, I totally get it. And I think at the time, they probably looked at me as just like a, you know, here's an annoying graduate student. It's going to go away. It's not a big deal. And they really were kind of silent until the book came out. And then they just, they became a lot more aggressive. Like, they wrote a response to something I wrote in the Atlanta Business Chronicle saying, I don't understand the free enterprise system or something like that.
Yeah, it is too
bad. I agree with you completely. Like, it's just silly. It's like, nothing's going to get done so far as people say it's just them versus us. Mm-hmm. And that was never the intention. I do not think there are bad humans in Coca-Cola doing bad things intentionally to ruin the planet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I sincerely believe a lot of them want to do good. But I think we need history if we're going to really be able to make sustainable businesses. And we don't have any history and as part of the conversation of sustainability platforms today. You know, I just don't think we're there. We're not in the room. And that's silly.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.